Right. Welcome back, everyone. Happy New Year. My name is George Tooley. I'm a teaching fellow for the Warwick Writing Programme. And my contact details are on the back of the handout if you want to get in touch with me about anything in this lecture. This is my first lecture, so go easy on me, please, if you will. This lecture is on writing about modern war, and specifically 20th century war, and trying to give an overview of what happens in the 20th century in terms of writing about war is incredibly difficult in 50 minutes. So I'm going to force a few gaps, identify a few things that you could chase up yourself and approach this talk in a very biased way. The hope is you'll be encouraged to trigger your own research ideas in this. I'm going to focus exclusively on poetry. You will be looking at prose in the next few weeks in class and in lectures. And the poems I've chosen to illustrate the talk are pretty idiosyncratic, bar one. I'm assuming you'll have no knowledge of any of them, which is fine. I'm also assuming that you've all some basic familiarity with First World War poets, soldier poets like Sassoon and Owen, as well as a few key modernist writers like Pound, Wolfe, Joyce, and Eliot's Wasteland. So I'm going to skip those, but make references to them during the course of the lecture. Okay. Loosely speaking, I'm going to cover three periods of 20th century warfare in chronological order. The first will be First World War and the modernist revolution. I'm using that term loosely. The second will be World War II, and a comparison of soldier poetry versus non-combatant poetry, home front poetry. And finally, I'm going to look at understanding war through myth and history, and that'll be focusing on Vietnam and the Gulf. The one key thing I'd like you to hold on to as I talk about these periods is the notion that major social upheavals caused by or triggers of global conflicts occur in relation to major shifts in dominant cultural trends. Those are heavily loaded terms, I know, but just bear with me. That's what I want you to keep in mind. While there's not necessarily consistency in how it happens, I'm fairly confident in saying that war and aesthetic change, they do go hand in hand with society's upheavals. So each section of the lecture will highlight different aspects of this idea, and the ideas that I'll throw up, though they're not specific, they'll be tied to specific periods, they won't be specific to those periods, so you should be able to apply those ideas across different different periods of writing about war in the 20th century. Again, you can work this out for yourself. But before I get into the bulk of it, there are a few factors I want you to keep in mind. First of all, gender issues. Male depictions of women and women writing about war. In my view, women are generally heavily emphasized in domestic roles by soldier poets, and even to some extent non-combatant poets. They're idolized for the homeland they present or represent. And before researching this lecture, I couldn't name off the top of my head a single female combatant poet. I've since found poetry by Corporal Chantel Brown, printed in the Sunday Times magazine last year, Blood, Bombs, and Bards. There's an article that's linked to in the references at the back of your handout. And there's a few poems by her which are absolutely god-awful, frankly. But they are there, they exist. So bear that in mind. I'm not going to tackle this in any detail, but it's an issue to think about. Also, the literacy issue. How many people could afford a good education well enough to write good poetry who were sent to war? Generally, soldiers are from the lower classes. The officer class are from the middle classes and have a better education. Quick history recap there. 1918, the first Education Act in Britain, made school compulsory up to age 14. The 1944 revision to the Act, which was delayed from 1939 for obvious reasons, defined the primary and secondary school system we have today with state and grammar schools. And in 1947, the compulsory leaving age was raised to 15. I don't have literacy figures to hand. You can look them up if you're interested. But I think it's safe to say that the First World War poets are generally from middle or upper class families with better educations. Their poetry is of that standard. But by Vietnam, you could say that there are more working class voices making themselves heard, and that World War II maybe exists in a kind of interim phase of that. But the ones that survive for cultural reasons, that's completely subjective. And I'm not gonna get into that. And finally, there's this idea of the long poem, or extended projects. I want to flag up the fact that some of the poems I've selected here by non-combatant poets, and many of the ones that I've encountered, they tend towards long poetry or sequences, broken up into shorter pieces often, but generally they're large, ambitious-scale projects. And I've had a sense in my reading that war demands a kind of a greater care, maybe. The moral issues thrown up by war tend to demand a more in-depth investigation by non-combatant poets. And the idea of short lyrics, which you might be familiar with from soldier poets, is something I'll come to in section two. But just bear in mind that a lot of these are extracts in the lecture or part of wider projects. Okay? Any questions so far? Good, because I'm not going to answer any. Right. World War I and the Modernist Revolution. So, I originally intended to frame this lecture around the idea of history is written by the winners and poetry is written by the losers. That's no comment on what poets are like, really. But that doesn't really hold weight if we start with some of the early modernist movements. To begin with, quotation 8 on your handout. I will read these. You don't have to follow them on the handout if you don't want to. This is from the Futurist Manifesto, penned in 1909 by F.T. Marinetti. Just two extracts from a longer document, which you'll find online if you follow the link. Literature has, up to now, magnified pensive immobility, ecstasy, and slumber. We want to exalt movements of aggression, feverish sleeplessness, the double march, the perilous leap, the slap and the blow with the fist. And we want to glorify war, the only cure for the world. Militarism, patriotism, the destructive gesture of the anarchists, the beautiful ideas which kill, and contempt for women. Not sure why he tagged that on at the end, but indeed, is there any irony in this? Poets have studied this, people I've spoken to say no. This is directly what they wanted, to cure the world through violence. So what you're establishing here is a period at the start of the 20th century in which violence is seen as a solution to social problems. And it's a period of manifestos. You've got aesthetic declarations and calls for change by organized groups like the Vorticists, early modernist movements, the Imagists, declaring their manifestos, their statements of intent, the Futurists as well. And the war appears, as a result, as much a symptom of social upheaval, of the need for change, as the poetry that's produced, the aesthetic changes and cultural shifts that are taking place in Europe. There was a call for violent change, not only amongst right-wing ideologists like Marinetti, but also with the rising labour movement, led by left-wing intellectuals in Britain like Edward Carpenter and George Bernard Shaw. The outcomes of this in Europe, you've got Bolshevism in a social context, for example. But you also have then Surrealism and Dadaism, some of the stronger modernist movements taking place. And these take up a central position in the cultural mainstream of public life. So people are aware of what's going on, even if at the time the books aren't selling, the poetry isn't selling particularly much. So I'm going to take you to an example of this. Guillaume Apollinaire, the first poem on your handout. This will give you a flavour of the aesthetic and social violence of the times. This is a version of Apollinaire's poem by a Birmingham poet, Jackie Rowe. Merveille de la guerre. How lovely they are, signalling dark, peaks of coryphée, eyes, arms, hearts, your smile, your breathing, daily apotheosis of your comet hair, gilts on these gilt dancers whose belonging is to bear young with their moments to die. How lovely these rockets, alphabetic inscribe, life entire and relative. Departing, I see them offer, conceal selves, moving fingers over fire, juggling, festival earth hungry, opens long, pale mouth, how aroma of toasted skin becomes not disagreeable. If sky ate with land there, it would only in not nourishing swallow souls. But I have run with sweetness. How this war, all guts length from me, has flames crying that I am here. have ploughed the beds I pour myself in. Thousand little rivers at prow of trench. I am still on all sides. I am one beginning this thing for epochs longer than flight of Icarus. I bequeath this story of Guillaume Apollinaire, who handled war and knew himself everywhere contented in towns, behind in all remains of universes, in one barbed and trampled, in women, cannon, horse, top to bottom, at all four points, unmistakable heat of wake. Certain it was lovelier. If I could have supposed all things I am part of might occupy me, but nothing can in sense I am, over all only, am in me, me. I'll repeat that line in the middle. Aroma of toasted skin becomes not disagreeable. Here you have someone trying to accustom themselves to the violence of modern military technology. But the poem is also enacting a syntactical violence, an experimentation of image, strange juxtapositions of metaphors. And it's forcing the reader in a way to try and accustom themselves as well to the way they perceive poetry. So the poem is enacting both the social violence that people have to accustom themselves to and the aesthetic violence of the poetry that can represent these situations. And Apollinaire was, aside from being killed in 1918, I think a few days after the war, he died of an illness, complicated, I think, by dysentery. But he was credited with inventing the term surrealism. And hopefully you can see why here. You know, the poet running with sweetness and trenches he has poured himself in, which is a far cry from the realism of Owen's Dulce et Decorum Est, for example. And you compare this to the other modernist aesthetic shifts that are taking place. I've used the term revolution so far, but really I want to talk about the idea of a paradigmatic shift. I don't know if you're familiar with this idea. A paradigmatic shift is the point where society has changed to such an extent that it can no longer be understood in the traditional terms with which you've measured society up to that point. And often they're accompanied by major technological shifts as well. And here you have weapons of mass death emerging, such as gas attacks. You have the first military aircraft deployments taking place in the First World War. At the same time, aesthetically, Pound is declaring that he has broken the pentameter. You familiar with that phrase, the breaking of the pentameter? Ezra Pound gets up on his podium, does the PR statement for modernism. And he's attacking the rigid metronome of Victorian verse, which, in his view, could no longer capture the new rhythms of the contemporary society that he was living in, he was going through. But similarly, there are other attacks taking place, like Joyce in Portrait of the Artist and Wolfe in Orlando. They're staging attacks on Victorian ideas of biography and how to write about the self and reality through experimental applications of aesthetic devices. And so you also have high and low dictions mixing in the new poetries, such as jazz rhythms in the wasteland. And that's alongside the blending of, say, Greek dialects in George Seferis' writings from the period, from, say, the 20s and 30s and so on. They're mixing high and low diction, street rhythms. And this attributes some of what Graham MacDonald was saying last term, the last lecture, about the nounless Brummies in Henry Green's Living. An approach was enabled by the early modernist experimentation. But these shifts in society, they merely establish a new order of oligarchs. You have Hitler and Stalin rising up, new imperialists. The ideals fail, and World War II then emerges, perhaps in reaction to the earlier experiments. And this, perhaps, in my view, is because of the failures to provide a better society by modernism. The experimentation doesn't amount to anything. And perhaps it's because of the violence embedded in the early movements, perhaps not, it's hard to say. But a counter-reaction has to take place. Before we get into that, I'm just going to take a little break to check on the audio and set something up. So just relax, talk among yourself, and I'm just going to set something up here, if I can. Would you mind being a guard?
No, but I bought my coat just for me.
That's all right. I've got a water pistol. Well, it's not a water pistol, it's a jug.
The
next section, how to kill. While I'm reading, I'll have everyone raise their hand and be absolutely quiet. If anyone moves to put their hands down or talk or make an announcement, we'll shoot them. Simple enough? So that's the lock, so make sure that's slid back and then just squeeze that to fire.
It does work, I've done it.
Simple enough? So, just up and down
the bar. What about
collateral damage is okay, so you can have casual things to take place.
Can you just do that aisle? I'll do that aisle. Yeah.
Cheers. That's
great. Okay. Okay. Quiet down, please. Next section. We're on to World War II and soldier poetry versus home front poetry. Quick précis to this next section. It's hard to pinpoint exactly why I find, personally, poetry written on the front lines, often by individuals without technical skills, breadth of reading, or perhaps the time to practice poetry, have such an emotional power to their writing. I'm sure you've all felt it reading the First World War poets. But something about the experience of soldier poets faced so immediately with mortality, their own mortality with others, charges their work. And it's perhaps only possible to really understand this fully by having a sense of it oneself, to experience it oneself. But you can see that the work itself carries a shadow of death through to the readers in safer places anyway. But we're going to try a little practical demonstration now, just a brief one. A mere flicker of this reality. I don't have a loaded weapon, don't worry. But just for the purposes of this experiment, I'd like you to let your imaginations take over a little, to try and tap into this feeling of anxiety. Just a little. Don't panic. But with the aid of two guards, I'm going to read a poem. And there'll be some simple rules for this. You're just going to keep your hands raised and not say a word while I read this poem. And if you lower your hands, or speak, or make a noise, or if your mobile phone goes off, can't check it now, you'll be shot by one of our guards, who are armed with water pistols. Nothing so dangerous. Okay, you should be familiar with this poem. So, by Keith Douglas, How to Kill. Under the parabola of a ball, a child turning into a man, I looked into the air too long. The ball fell in my hand. It sang in the closed fist, open, open. Behold, a gift designed to kill. Now in my dial of glass appears the soldier who is going to die. He smiles and moves about in ways his mother knows, habits of his. The wires touch his face. I cry, now! Death, like a familiar, hears, and look has made a man of dust of a man of flesh. This sorcery I do. Being damned, I am amused to see the center of love diffused in the wave of love, travel into vacancy. How easy it is to make a ghost. The weightless mosquito touches her tiny shadow on the stone. and with how like, how infinite a likeness, man and shadow meet. They fuse. A shadow is a man when the mosquito death approaches. Thank you, guards. Corporal Trigger-Happy Rajans and Brigadier Weston. So, I don't know if you could feel something there, a little flicker of what happens. Having someone point something at you is always a little bit anxiety-inducing. But having live ammunition pointed at you, or even in your own hands, is a threat of some kind that is far beyond that. But you can feel a little bit of it. And here we have the casual instantaneousness of death played out in the hands of language. Only a representation as well, but an effective one. Reviewing Desmond Graham's biography of Keith Douglas for Poetry Nation in 1975, Roger Garfitt noted, "Graham himself shows, by reference to the early drafts, how the writing of How to Kill involved the suppression of personal vulnerability, of the image of Douglas's own death in favour of an objective enactment of vulnerability in general." So Douglas plays out the ease of his own death in killing an enemy. Every kill, above all the easiest, the most instantaneous kills, that idea of the ball falling in the hand, the grenade, or the dial of the sniper's crosshair. Those easy deaths, those instantaneous kills, are a reminder of how easy it is to lose your own life in a battle, just like that. Now compare that to an extract written almost the same year, from HD's long poem. This again is on the handout, if you want to follow it. It's from a long poem called Trilogy, and this is from section 1, The Walls Do Not Fall. It's part 38. "This search for historical parallels, research into psychic affinities, has been done to death before, will be done again. No comment can alter spiritual realities, you say. Or again, what new light can you possibly throw upon them? My mind, yours, your way of thought, mine. Each has its peculiar, intricate map. Threads weave over and under the jungle growth of biological aptitudes, inherited tendencies, the intellectual effort of the whole race, its tide and ebb. But my mind, yours, has its peculiar, egocentric, personal approach to the eternal realities and differs from every other in minute particulars, as the vein paths on any leaf differ from those of every other leaf in the forest, as every snowflake has its particular star, coral, or prism shape." It's hard to recognize this as a poem about war directly, but it was written during the Blitz and has references to the London railings being pulled up and melted down for ammunition and things like that. And it's full of philosophy, conjecture, but also image and rhythm. There's no doubt in my mind, personally, which is aesthetically and intellectually the better poem, to my taste. But emotionally, yes, HD was moved to respond to the chaos of the Blitz, but she has time to reflect, to extend her meditations and dissipate her emotional recollections across a wider space. Soldier poetry, perhaps through the conditioning of environment, is immediate, intense, distilled into short lulls, often written in short lulls between battles, short gaps that they have, to the sound of gunfire, explosions, military operations. Time is not a luxury. The present moment is everything, and this is conveyed in poetry written on the front lines. HD herself, heavily influenced by Freud, underwent analysis. She began these projects 30 years earlier with the images. There's nothing particularly new about what she's doing by the 40s, and she's essentially a late modernist at this stage. And the poems demonstrate this experimentation with image, the continuation of mythic underpinnings and Freudian psychoanalysis. And Douglas also could be said to be quite conventional in many ways. He's writing to a kind of level that wouldn't be far removed from the First World War poets. You could read this poem alongside Sassoon or Owen, and it might sit there in that period very easily. What's to set it apart? But the Second World War, as I was saying just before the break, is closely followed by an abandonment of the modernist project, at least along mainstream channels. Critic Marjorie Perloff puts it this way. The real fate of first stage modernism was one of deferral, its radical and utopian aspirations being cut off by the catastrophe first of the Great War and then of the series of crises produced by the two great totalitarianisms that dominated the first half of the century and culminated in World War II and the subsequent Cold War. So the experiments begin before World War I, and the reactions begin almost immediately for her. She goes on to say that between the two World Wars and well beyond the second one, it almost seems as if poems and artworks made a conscious effort to repress the technological and formal inventions of modernism at its origins. So what you get is post-World War II Britain suddenly trumping up the movement poets, epitomised by Larkin and a kind of sneering, stiff upper lippedness. And of course, I warn you that my biases on Larkin, I'm happy to wear on my sleeve here. I think he's evil. But the movement and the cultural domination of his kind of group of poets in post-war Britain, it's a kind of rejection of modernist experimentation. It's throwing it back and saying, no, we don't want this anymore. Similarly, in the US, you have a movement called the New Formalists rising up, championing traditional forms, rhyme, meter, bringing back that stuff that modernist society, the Victorians, could keep to themselves. It's as if these upheavals during the first few decades of the century are rejected out of a kind of disillusionment, you might say. They failed to prevent a second war, to put things right, as it were. And World War II is this justification for that. And it also then divorces post-war experiments in poetry from social or political significance. It's as if postmodernism and the movements attached to it become classified falsely, of course, as kind of pale imitations of a failed elitist period of aesthetic obsession. Modernism equally is divorced, to some extent, from its political ramifications. The Wasteland is one of the greatest 20th century anti-war poems ever written, right? So, that's food for thought. I don't have time to go into it too much. You can see this kind of jumping back taking place post-World War II, looking back to an earlier era, just the way that in some ways the modernists were doing, jumping back before Victorianism. So, section three, if you're still following me. Come to this stage then to kind of crystallize these ideas a little. Understanding war through myth and history, focusing on Vietnam and the Gulf. I'm going to play you a little extract, if this is all working still, in a bit. But a little pricey introduction to this. In 1971, after having completed alternative service to the military, working for a humanitarian agency that treated war-injured children, John Balaban returned to Vietnam. So he'd been out there, drafted in to a non-combatant role in the war zone, but he returned. The war was still on, and he was aiming, in his return, to capture Gad Zhao. Sadao on the handout here, C-A-D-A-O. I'm told it's pronounced Gad Zhao. And he describes them as folk poems composed by Vietnamese rural people for hundreds of years and passed down over the generations by song. His purpose was to understand Vietnam with greater depth. He was told the only way to really understand Vietnamese culture was through Gad Zhao. Very simply, he approached people in villages in Vietnam with a tape recorder and asked them to sing their favorite poems. So here's a sample of the original here.
Quê mẹ
little flavor. I don't know which poem that is, because the translations aren't provided for the audio, but you can listen to and read more of these at John Balaban's website, www.johnbalaban.com, which is on the handout as well. But here are a few of the poems themselves in English, which he translated. The body is pain. At the outpost now, for 3 years, by day, on guard. My nights, the mandarin plans, clearing bamboo, slashing wood stands. The body is pain. I can't complain. My food is bamboo shoots and plums. My fuel and friends are the bamboo. In the well, one fish swims alone and free. The red cloth. Sad, idle, I think of my dead mother, her mouth chewing rice, her tongue removing fish bones. The red cloth drapes the mirror frame. Men of one country should love one another. The outpost soldier. Here are only cliffs and crags, bird tracks, beasts shuffling, locusts chirring, and jungle trees rustling their music. A bird calls out from a gnarled tree. I've lived in the forest for 3 years. So a question to ask yourselves, perhaps to start with, is when are these poems about? The details aren't time specific, but you take a reference about the dead mother, about soldiers standing guard in the middle of a jungle with no one around. What does that mean? You apply it to what you know as a reader. There's a resonation as a result in new historical contexts. You can read these poems as a kind of reference to Vietnam, to the Gulf War perhaps, to wars in Korea, to a war 200 years ago perhaps. They resonate through time. And what you find, I mean, if you ask, why did Balaban hunt them down? Why was he interested in these? Sure, to understand Vietnamese culture, that's a superficial reason. What else is at work here? He's trying to access the cultural history of a place, to humanize it, to depict for a very biased understanding, American understanding, perhaps, specifically, the idea of real human beings with a poetic, lively tradition that takes place, to humanize these people in the face of American government propaganda, demonizes, reduces to a mosquito that can be killed like that. You know, that line, men of one country should love one another. Great resonation. It's almost a religious line. And the isolation of the soldier also resonates. The relationship with nature, the detachment from other people. This kind of cut-offness. So, sidestep to the Gulf War, for another example. This is the last poem I want to look at in the lecture, but you can read and discuss the others in the seminars if you like. This is an extract from Michael Hulse's long poem, Mother of Battles. Again, long poem, sequentially, various parts. This is from the opening section, bombing. It was on the first page, the handouts. Lady of the cypress and the cedar, lady of the land between the rivers, lady of the silence of the stones, the dusty silence in the olive grove, the dusty silence in the vineyard. He was toiling all the morning, all the afternoon. At night he said, you look like Madonna, like Marilyn Monroe, like Greta Garbo, like Jean Harlow. He said that your breasts were like clusters of grapes, of dates, like clusters of grapes on the vine, like clusters of dumb iron bombs. The voice of the B-52 is heard in the land. Very immediate, passionate poem here. And Michael is in the department if you want to question him about it or get hold of a longer copy, a full copy. The lady in the poem addressed is Inanna, Sumerian goddess of sexual love, fertility, and warfare. But she's also one of the female American soldiers fighting in the Gulf War in the early 90s. This is one of the first wars in which women were known publicly to be drafted and fighting in combat, right? And the poem recounts the myth, but it starts to blur the boundaries between the present and a culture that existed 5,000 to 6,000 years ago, ancient Sumeria. And the poem also blurs the traditionally masculine activity of war, seeking to accommodate female soldiers. Traditionally, females in battle are classed in a very mythic role, the Amazonian tribes, this kind of weird iconography. They're not allowed into the normal male space of war. But here, the woman is devoid of that iconography. What do you do? Do you call her an Amazon? Michael Hulse is establishing this new kind of iconography, this new set, and he's drawing on Hollywood icons for this, in this particular section, drawing on various parallels to identify a woman in battle in this role. So this mythic parallelism is what I want to emphasize. Whereas in Balaban you have historical parallels being drawn, an attempt to create a sense of history in a place before violence, which is all that the American public would have known in the 70s, you have here myth being used to try and understand reality. You should be familiar with this from Eliot, from The Wasteland, from the cantos of Pound. And you have here the aesthetic delivery, drawing on traditional forms as well in Hulse's poem. You have the hieratic dialects of litany, orthodox ritual. You have high and low dialects mixing later on in the poem. You have American soldier slang alongside these kind of biblical references, direct syntactical lifts from the Song of Solomon and so on. And Eliot was doing this too, of course. You know, he threw sonnets into the wasteland, almost perfect sonnets, alongside jazz rhythms, alongside mixes of dialects. This is a modernist poem, very clearly. But what ties these poetries about war together is perhaps this quest to try and understand society better. The point where society itself has reached a stage, perhaps a paradigmatic shift, if you want to use that term, where it can no longer be understood in traditional manners. That the preceding period of history is no longer relevant. So you have to jump back, jump sideways, jump to alternative understandings that let you explain the violence you're now living in. Myth and history are recourse for poets who return to earlier times. And some use rigid forms, some seek free verse. These are aesthetic differences that they choose, comparing the modernists to the movement poets, for example. But most do tend to reject the era immediately preceding their own in favour of much earlier times. And this is perhaps out of a sense of blaming the parents. And this takes us to Larkin, of course. This be the verse. They fuck you up, your mum and dad. Yeah? So you have this recurring idea of rejecting the old in favour of something even older, the deeper magic of Aslan, perhaps. But how far a poet goes back, how they engage with it, varies across these different ideas, these different periods, these different movements. So, that's three stages. In recap, we've covered how the first few decades of the 20th century delivered great social and aesthetic upheavals, and how the reaction to these experiments came to a head in the Second World War, with its basic assumption that everything's failed to this point. Experimentation no longer serves us, perhaps. I've examined the contrast between poetry written by combatants and non-combatants. And you can see there the intensity of the short lyrics produced by soldier poets, which I wouldn't say is a catch-all description, but generally runs par for course for me. And it's only after these soldier poets have left the war zone that they can produce longer pieces. And how the aesthetic and emotional differences in environment places pressures upon the poets to write in a certain way. And finally, this idea of looking at how history is used to try and make sense of the present, and how poets project themselves backwards in time into history and myth to do this, and how pretty much every one of these periods I've talked about does have poetry that does that in different ways. So that's about it. Brief reminder before I just sum up finally. That my email is on the handout, so if there's anything unclear in this, do email. And there's some further reading as well to suggest further ideas for research and so on. Some of them quite idiosyncratic, like these poems have been. But you can weigh them up against my ideas, see what you come up with. I want to leave you with two quotations, specifically connected to World War II, but you can read them in the context of other war poetry if you like. The first, you'll be familiar with the kind of bastardized form of this quotation, "No poetry after Auschwitz," which is a misquote of Theodore Adorno is saying. to write poetry after Auschwitz is barbaric. And this corrodes even the knowledge of why it has become impossible to write poetry today. To write poetry after Auschwitz is barbaric. And as counter to that, Gillian Rose. To argue for silence, prayer, the banishment equally of poetry and knowledge, in short, the witness of ineffability, that is, non-representability, is to mystify something we dare not understand. Because we fear that it may be all too understandable, all too continuous with what we are. Human, all too human. So is it better, then, to remain silent? To remove aesthetic experimentation from language in the way that poetry demands? Because it's barbaric, because aesthetics demands a certain quietude? Or should we speak out and acknowledge human evil? Does it need to be recorded? And if so, how best to express our reactions to war? I'm hoping that these poems will give you a starting point to understand some of the challenges faced by poets writing about war and how each of them make different decisions regarding overcoming these obstacles.